Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said. Done.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
I'm feeling like an art freak.
Good. Do you know what? What is that?
Well, why do you think it
someone
is?
Someone said the other day, I did an interview the other day for... BBC News. I was at the Turner Contemporary in Margate, and it was during the Turner Prize. And the guy doing the interview beforehand did a little research question. And he said to me, like, "How do you describe yourself? Why are you so into the arts?" And I said, "Because I'm a bit of an art geek. I'm a bit of a nerd." And then the interview started, and he went, "So you describe yourself as an art freak?" And I went, "Well, not so much freak, more geek." He said, "Well, you know, freak, geek, same thing, isn't it?" I was like, "Well, maybe, more nerd. Let's say geek or nerd rather than art freak."
I quite like art freak, though. I think we should own that.
I'm going to claim it now.
I think we are art freaks.
We are art freaks.
And we do love art a bit too much.
Yes.
So our guest today has come all the way from New York, and she is a hero to both yourself
the
and
biggest.
Mine.
I'm so
we're
excited.
Both completely obsessed.
Yes.
And the funniest thing is, Russell told me about your work maybe, I don't know, like 3 months ago, 4 months ago, because you had a show in London here. Mm-hmm. And I looked at it all and was like, I thought I wasn't familiar. And then I realized just today that I saw a show of yours in, I think, mid-2000s, mm-hmm. like 2004, five, that Kenny Schachter put on at the Rove Gallery. I think it was in Hoxton Square, maybe.
It was Hoxton Square.
And that show was incredible because a friend of mine at the time was obsessed with like Genesis Peorage. Mm. And I was quite new to the art world and was sort of learning as much as I could. And she was teaching me about these kind of like artists that weren't necessarily at like Hauser & Wirth right now you know, at the White Cube, but artists who were doing really amazing work kind of on the outside of the art world in a way, and but still, you know, doing exhibitions and everything. And you were one of the artists that she told me about. So I've actually seen a show of yours back then and I loved it. And I was making music back then. So I've come from a music background, gone into the art world. And then our guest today is someone who crosses many different
mediums,
art forms.
Yes.
And I guess the way of summing her up would just be to say she's a multidisciplinary artist.
Totally.
And uses like sound and photography and her own body and her incredible mind.
Yes.
Is probably
and
the
energy.
Most powerful tool for her artwork.
Yes.
But we're massive fans. We would
massive.
Like to welcome Kembra Fela.
Hello, everybody.
How are you
hello.
Doing?
Hello. I'm really well, thank you.
Good.
It's great to be here. I feel really flattered, and I don't deserve all this praise, really.
No,
I think I've been so fortunate just to be able to stay alive all these years and get to show up for all these, you know, shows. And I never really expected to get to have such a nice gallery now, like Leopold and Emmalin. It's worked out very nicely to get to work with a gallery based in London.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just been like a big surprise, all of this exhibiting that's happened. I had a boyfriend who was called Colin Deland in 2002, and that's really one of the only reasons that I started having larger art shows. I was doing The Voluptuous Sword of Karen Black, my band, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I never, ever went to galleries. I never went to museums. And Colin Deland, an art dealer, kept calling me on the phone, wanting to meet me, and asked me to come in and do an art exhibit. And we fell in love, and he became my boyfriend. he died of cancer a few years later. He was also married to Pat Hearn. And Pat Hearn and Colin Deland were two of the originators of what is commonly known as the modern day art fair. They started the Armory.
Wow. Oh, right.
It was Pat and Colin who, they were the first people to do small shows that included all sorts of artists from around the globe. They did a show at Chateau Marmont in the 90s in the hotel rooms, and they instigated this new trend of armory art fairs, right. Really. And Colin was known as the Keith Richards of the art world. He was very, very intelligent. He was a linguist. He was a philosopher, and also he did artwork. So one of his art projects was running a gallery. He had a pseudonym that was John Dog. He would show sculpture as well. He came up with Richard Prince, right. And Richard Prince went in one direction. I think many of the New York galleries that you see today that are involved with people that are interdisciplinary like me, mm-hmm. It's because of Colin.
Really?
Because Colin brought me in, and when he brought me in, it was not popular to deal with queer art, trans art, people from bands. Debbie Harry would always come to art shows, but no one was offering Debbie Harry a show. John Waters was always coming to art shows, but it was Colin that said to John Waters, do you want to have an art show?
Wow.
So it was really Colin that brought me into this. It was kind of my second wave of art world stuff. I did art world stuff in the 80s in New York, uh-huh. But I got bored, so I left.
I would love to talk about
in
that.
In the 80s, I got bored, I left.
Your life, because I heard about the amazing kind of week-long installation you did where you were like sleeping in a window of a gallery, and you kind of made this very, I think you described it as really like unwatchable or unenjoyable or something like that.
It wasn't entertaining. Entertaining because I was in the first decade of my work, and I don't know if you've had this experience, either of you, when you're starting out, you're experimenting, and I don't think any of us should really know exactly who we are and what we are mm-hmm. when we're just beginning. And I think, you know, I was trying on different practices. And
what was the show? What did you actually do in the window then for the week?
I slept in the window, and it was about availabism, making the best use of what's available. Uh-huh. It was at a gallery called ABC No Rio. And, excuse me, and it was just something that I felt like doing, and I was tired. And it was a way to also integrate into the neighborhood, because the neighbors thought that we were so ridiculous. The Puerto Rican and Dominicans of the 80s, you know, they weren't art lovers.
Was it Lower East Side then?
Yeah, it was right, on Rivington Street.
Right.
And it was the time when there were all these different scenes in the Lower East Side. There was the David Wojnarowicz scene, the Karen Finley scene, the kind of mud club scene, and then
who's Karen Finley?
She's a great performance artist who now runs the performance department of NYU Tisch School of Performance
really?
Art. Yeah, and she did a great piece. I suggest to everyone who's listening to your show called "We Are the Black Sheep," and she was really good friends with David.
Really. Was you good friends with David? Did you know him?
I did know him, yeah. But I'm a little bit younger, just a little bit younger than Karen and David. Mm-hmm. And for some reason at that time, I was still like forming. I was an unformed stone or something.
But did you look to Karen for like inspiration? Was she someone that's really pushed you in that direction as well?
I guess because I'm such a punk brat from Los Angeles, no one inspired me whatsoever. And I never would I grew up in Los Angeles as a baby, and I was very anti-celebrity because I got hold of Kenneth Anger's Hollywood Babylon when I was in sixth grade. And
what's that about?
Kenneth Anger is a filmmaker, and he's kind of a really important figurehead and father to us all who we're interested in film, but we're interested in film not mainstream Hollywood film necessarily. Kenneth made his own films. Mm-hmm. He made Fireworks. Mm-hmm. He made Fireworks?
Yeah,
Fireworks. Not Fireworks. He didn't make Fireworks. He made a film called Fireworks. He was an early queer icon. You would love him, maybe, his work. And he's exhibiting a lot now. He's over 90 years old now. Kenneth was born in by the beach where I'm from, in Santa Monica, Malibu. So I grew up loving art and film, but I didn't really want necessarily to go into Hollywood.
Did you feel a pressure being in Santa Monica of assuming that you would then be?
I did, yeah.
But also, as a young child, you were actually like in a Kodak advertising campaign.
I was always in commercials.
Were you?
Yeah.
My aunt was a casting director who worked for Ron Howard, Stephen King, Catherine Bigelow,
who did
Near Dark,
yeah.
and did The Hurt Locker.
Yeah.
So I was surrounded by Hollywood stuff, and that was never the kind of film that I liked necessarily, but I loved film. So I don't know. There was two kind of worlds that existed in tandem, and my world wasn't very popular, and I didn't really engage with celebrities that much. It was they. So what I'm trying to say was when Karen was never really, and the people that I looked up to in New York, they became friends. They became collaborators, mm-hmm. and it was a different vibe than just looking up to them. You know, mm-hmm. It was a good thing actually, because Karen would always encourage younger people to do their work and to make performance. I remember when she saw some of my first early performances, this woman that I very much looked up to, she just was like, finally, you're getting the picture or something. Karen Finley, I loved. I really recommend her. Kenneth Anger,
so
I really
collaborate
recommend.
Together, though? Did you do?
We've done shows together, but at the time she was blowing up in the 80s. She was number one performance artist of the world. She was in Spin magazine, and she was really hot, you know. And then I think she kind of left New York and moved to the country for a while. So I don't know. She's around. She's at NYU. If she comes around, I would definitely see Karen.
Oh, great.
And talk to her about David. And they made films together with someone called Richard Kern.
Yes, who you've worked with as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I did. I don't really have a lot of experience speaking on shows like this, although I've done a few. I'm sorry if I'm rambling.
No, you're
honestly, you are like our best guest ever. We love you.
We're loving
you. We have nothing but love for you. And
look, I'm never leaving, by the way. wouldn't that be Harlan?
We're like your fan club.
What if I had just sort of like an episode right now and like had a breakdown and would never leave? I don't think you'd like me then.
We would take care of you. We would take care of you.
So we could treat it as a performance. That's fine.
It's totally fine.
I'm just kidding. I won't do that.
So
my students do that, by the way.
Do they?
I just taught yesterday at Columbia.
All right.
And everyone was crying in the class, so sad and so upset. Everyone is cracking up.
To come London? Or?
No, that the whole world is melting and dying and fucked as it can be.
Yep.
It is quite a traumatizing time, though, I think, at the moment.
It is.
Do you feel like in times like this that good art comes out of it? Because your experience of the 80s is that most of your best friends were taken away by AIDS.
Yeah, they died of AIDS.
And that would have... Do you feel that time politically affected art that was being made?
Totally. I think always in every decade you have to, like Raina Maria Rilke says, it's our jobs as artists and people that love art to always find the greatness and the beauty, no matter what decade it is, no matter what's happening, that the world is coming to an end. Is better artwork being made? I don't know. I've always been inspired by great artworks. It's the only thing that's really fortified me.
Yeah.
Like, I don't take exciting vacations. This is like exciting vacation to me to see your art collection. I don't go to Saint-Tropez or to Matt. Well, actually, I do.
Sometimes.
And I go to Hawaii too. So I do go to nice places, but it's not – it's really always nice to come to people's studios and see the artwork that they have. That's my favorite thing to do.
What have you seen recently that you've liked?
Well, I went to Palais de Tokyo.
Yes.
And I went to the Thierry Mugler show, and I loved the drawings Thierry Mugler did in the 80s of all of his models and his clothes. And I saw Rick Owens' show
in
Paris, and I saw...
I love his furniture. Have you seen his furniture? Like the stag's horn and that the very square, robust seating. And
yeah, we're going to do a show with Rick Owens at the Pompidou Centre.
Are you?
In October on the 18th.
Wicked.
So what is your involvement in that? You're
going to
be...
I'm one of his friends who's going to be one part of the sculpture.
Amazing.
It's going to be good.
That's so good.
And so it's me and Tommy Cash, the guy, the Albanian. I think he's from... You know where he's from, that rapper, Leopold? He's and Christine is going to be in that show.
You love
I'm obsessed with Christine.
Me too, obsessed too.
Yeah, a friend of mine, Zoe Badeau, she's actually curated a show that's on in my gallery in Margate at the moment.
Wow.
And it's looking at the history of
tights
and how they've been used in art. So it's got artists who are contemporary, like making art right now with tights. So
that's
there's
such
an artist
a good
from
idea.
South Africa called Chiria Magadlela, who's making work with hosiery and tights. And then there's also people like Louise Bourgeois and Sarah Lucas and kind of the icons that we're aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also people from the 70s.
There's Lee Bowery in there.
Lee Bowery's in there, and there's many different artists. It's an incredible show, and it covers so many different topics, from like feminism to racial politics to you know, even the use of tights for men and how maybe they've restricted or you know, made it harder for men somehow. It's a really interesting show, actually, and very, very deep.
But I can't wait to see that.
It's amazing.
She went to Christine's show on Sunday at the Barbican, and I was so exhausted because we've been setting up. It's got 22 artists in the show, so it's just been so demanding with freeze coming up and everything. So I didn't make it, but I've been messaging Christine on Instagram because I'm just totally in love. And
she messaged back or ignored you?
Yeah, no, we've been getting love hearts.
Right.
But I'm a big, big admirer of Christine as well. Yeah.
Me too.
And Zoe was with, I think, I don't know if Rick was there, but Rick's wife,
Michelle.
Exactly. They were all together a few weeks before the show.
I think
as well,
Rick and Michelle are coming here now, this week maybe.
Wicked. For freeze.
I don't know what they're coming here for exactly, but they're coming.
So you're in London for freeze. That's why you're here.
I'm here with Emmeline Gallery and Leopold Thun and Angelina Volk. They run Emmeline, and they asked me. Leopold asked me a few years ago if we could work together, and I had just done a show with Anoni and Coco Rosie and Johanna in New York called Future Feminism in 2014, and Jeffrey Deitch was my gallerist after Colin died, and I just decided that I wanted to work with Leopold and Angelina because I felt like they cared about my actual work.
Oh my God, they did. Well, that's how I came to your work, because I turned up at the gallery and you had a big sequin disco penis that was there, life size, big, like human size, man size. And I stood next to it and posed. And then I had the tour with Leo and I just completely became obsessed with you, and then came to watch all your videos of the voluptuous horror of Karen Black. And me and Rob were talking about this, and we want to be your Karen Blacks at some point. We want to come on and you body paint us. And
that
then
would be
amazing. We do things.
Are you kidding me? That would be so amazing.
We would absolutely love it. So let's talk about the voluptuous horror of Karen Black.
Okay.
How did that come about?
Pretty much I was married to Samoa, and we met. He was dancing on the bar of the pyramid. He's from Hiroshima, Japan.
Yeah.
And
so what's that like? So people still live in Hiroshima?
Well, he had left Japan, I guess, Samoa left Japan around 1980.
Uh-huh.
He was a rock and roll kid and wasn't very popular in his little small town near Hiroshima. So, yeah, his family are all like Hiroshima mutants, essentially. So Samoa started a band in Japan, studied extreme theater in Tokyo, and then ended up in New York City, like all of us brave weirdos from around the world who were going to be killed if we stayed in our hometowns. We all left to New York because New York was safe for us.
Is that what it felt like then, though? You felt like if you stayed where you were, you couldn't have been the person you needed to be?
No, because my look wasn't popular until the 90s. until I got discovered by Calvin Klein, and they started taking pictures, and the idea of beauty changed a little bit, mm-hmm. and black hair was embraced, and different body types were embraced, and you know, people, the older artists were people that kind of helped that to happen. Artists like Karen Vinley and Mary Heilman and Lorraine.
Yeah, because she taught you, didn't she, Mary Heilman? Yeah,
and Lorraine O'Grady. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just the older artists were kind of really catalytic in helping to wake up the culture to not be so mean-spirited towards us people that were queer and who weren't looking like blonde and skinny from Malibu. That's my background.
Well, one of the interesting things that I connected with in your work, which is quite funny because I'm a man, obviously, is this idea of body image. And I heard you speak really eloquently recently in a film. You were actually talking about the menopause and the idea of like getting older as a woman. This whole idea of like somehow taking control of your own body when you feel uncomfortable within it for, you know, as you're growing up. And you grew up in California and were surfing a lot. And I guess there was a lot of like, a certain type of a look in that place I just really connected with, and I had such empathy with. And it's like, from my, I used to be in a pop band and I grew up and people were always telling me to lose weight, and you know, you're constantly worried about being on stage and how you feel. But your work for me kind of liberates me. Like, I watch the way you're so physical and the way you use your body in such a powerful way, actually. And even you showed us a clip, a photograph Leopold showed us just before we started recording of you surfing, and I'm quite fascinated
as Karen Black.
Karen Black, like in full body paint. But even that physicality and this idea of how you've grown up with surfing and then how you've sort of
incorporated
moved into,
that
fascinating.
Well, I don't know where are you both from? Where were you growing up?
So I'm Essex, which is probably Jersey to New York,
I want to ask you both a million questions too, but like, how, you know, how did you, can I ask, is it rude to ask how you started doing all your acting things and all your plays and stuff?
I joined a drama club when I was a kid, got an agent, and then through doing mainly theatre, I made the transition from child to adult actor. And then it's sort of been, and plays for me the thing. So I would choose a play over anything else.
Wow.
And that, I feel like that is, the moments in my career and my life that have been the most important kind of revolved around plays.
Plays are really, and acting is really hard for me because I can't remember lines. And I find that when I was growing up in Los Angeles, I found that doing acting was something I wasn't good at.
Auditions and things like that.
I couldn't handle the emotional ins and outs that you had to do to go into characters.
Right.
I was too fragile emotionally, and I couldn't comprehend going in and out of characters.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't a method actor.
Mm-hmm.
And but I really loved strange movies, and I really loved theater and performance.
Mm-hmm.
I just couldn't do it. I couldn't handle it. It was too upsetting to me. Brilliant. I remember doing Under Milkwood, Dylan Thomas, and I just had a complete breakdown reading that text.
Wow.
And I couldn't, I didn't get cast. I was, didn't get cast in the play, and I couldn't understand why they wouldn't allow me to work on the play anyways and include me, like, can I do something else?
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't, around that kind of traditional theater, there wasn't the spirit of inclusion mm-hmm. that I found in punk in Los Angeles and in art. So that's sort of why I gravitated towards that, because I made a lot of mistakes, and I couldn't act, but I loved music and performance
mm-hmm.
and making beautiful things.
Mm-hmm.
To me, plays were beautiful things. I went to the Renaissance Fair every year with my auntie, and would watch all of the Renaissance plays, and I love the costumes at the Renaissance Fair. And I went to every film set that I could when I was growing up
mm-hmm.
To watch my aunt work. And so I guess what
your
I'm
aunt
trying to
say. Your
aunt
who's casting director.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you'd go and you'd see all the actors come in and...
I mean, I came to do what I'm doing similarly, probably to the same way you all did. You get, there's some spark of beauty and joy and creativity, and you think, this is beautiful. This is going to set me on a trajectory that might make life worth living. Because
mm-hmm.
I feel like great art and music and theater give us a reason to live. It's very healing to do artwork, it's like a panacea. It's made me stronger as well. I can't imagine life without being surrounded by beauty and challenging work. Mm-hmm. I just can't imagine it. Mm-hmm. You know,
I grew up outside London, like an hour outside London. And when I was a young kid, I did a lot of ballet and I wanted to be a ballet dancer until I was about 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. And then I started acting and I loved acting as well. But for me, acting was never right either, because I always felt like you had to be someone else's story.
But you liked all the hard stuff. You liked the theatre cruelty.
Yeah, I liked
Stephen Burkoff.
Yeah.
And he liked, like, I mean, I appreciate it, but Rob got immersed in it and
yeah,
loved
the really obsessed with it in
the
my
traumatic theatre.
Yeah. And then I started writing songs, and then that led me eventually to art as well. So, and I sort of gave up writing music and became a gallerist. Mm-hmm. So it's been this really odd journey in a way. But for me, it was often about trying to somehow work out my own story of, like,
well, what your creativity zone was, zoning, like trying to choose it, like where it was going to go.
Yeah, and self-portraiture. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I love what you do, because I feel like you've created like a character, I guess, but at the same time, it's so true to you and so purely like your soul. So it's almost like you've done all these films. I know you made like sort of horror films almost, and like and your albums. I feel like
But let's talk about the albums then. So we're talking about how you got to be Karen Black, how that got to be.
Because I grew up and I was terrible at school in Los Angeles. The school system's extremely boring, and it was a huge public school, and my mother had gone to the same school. So I walked into the classroom and my teacher, I remember Doris was her name, she said to me, "You're Judy Ray's kid, aren't you? Stand in the hallway." My teacher didn't like my mother, and we were like the bad kids. So I remember the day that I was told to stand in the hallway. I left the class and I thought, what am I doing standing here? I'm just going to leave. So I left the class, went to the beach, started just screwing around, making things. And school was so negligent in Southern California where I went. Mm-hmm. We were never accountable for attendance. I took my parents' pot. They had pot all over the house. This was the 60s in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. I went to the beach every day, and I started to develop my own mythology, my own vocabulary of images, because it was so incredibly boring in school and there was nothing to do. So I watched films all the time and television all the time. And I love the actress Karen Black, who made Five Easy Pieces, the Bob Rafelson film. Do you know that film?
No, don't know it.
Oh, I can't wait for you to see that.
Okay.
If you are doing, is it okay to say the play you're doing?
Yes.
If you love Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, you might love Bob Rafelson's Five Easy Pieces.
Okay.
Of course, you should watch it.
It's such a great film. Do you like that one too, Leopold? And I mean, it was the school of Dennis Hopper and Tony Basil. And Karen Black was from a time in Los Angeles where interdisciplinary extreme artists worked in the medium of film.
Wow. She always played kooky kind of screwball characters, didn't she?
Yeah, she was unusual looking. Uh-huh. And I loved her working with Robert Altman in the film called Nashville. Mm. So I always loved her films that she did. And when I was in New York, I met a filmmaker called Mike Kuchar and George Kuchar I met, and they inspired John Waters. And I actually started making films with Mike Kuchar, and I did a performance one night, and Mike said to me, "Kembra, your work's very voluptuously horrific." I said, "That's a very Baroque way to speak."
Wow.
Yeah.
And so I just, you know, as poems happen, they just pop into your head.
Yeah.
I named the band The Voluptuous Horror of Karen Black. And she came to my first show.
So you've
show.
Met Karen Black? I was about to ask that. You've met her.
She came to my first show in Los Angeles, and she got on stage and introduced us.
No way. That's so special.
Did she know what the work was? Had she seen you perform before?
Okay, first of all, the work was so ridiculously unpopular at the time, standing on my head and cracking eggs on my vagina, which stems from a Georges Bataille book called Story of the Eye. I mean, Karen Black is an extreme actress and artist, despite the fact that she got sucked into Scientology, like a lot of people in Los Angeles.
She did, right.
But I guess that worked for her because she was happy and well most of her life and worked all of her life. So I guess that cult worked for her. But she introduced us and she tried to pick up my drummer. She wanted to have sex with my drummer. And she said to me, she took me by the hand and looked me in the eye and said, I think you're a wonderful artist and I really love what you're doing and good luck with it.
Wow.
She never sued me. She never interfered with any of my web activity. She never did anything mean-spirited to me. And she always supported me. And I remember I did a show with Lou Reed at UCLA called The Raven. And we needed an actress to be in The Raven with us. So we hired Karen Black.
Oh, that's so good.
What an endorsement.
The thing is, though, the best artists always support other artists.
Yes, exactly.
And will applaud other artists. Yes. And also let you have your time. Do you know what I mean? Like, we'll try
she
and...
did.
Yeah, that's so wonderful and generous.
She did. And I wanted to do a benefit for her when she died of cancer. But it was funny because... just speaking of sizeism and misogyny and sexism and stuff, I went to meet her husband, mm-hmm. and I wanted to do a benefit for her and after she passed away, and to raise money for him because he lost his home after she died.
Wow.
He had a daughter, and I went out to dinner in Los Angeles with. I took my friend Hal Wilner with me, who's a great producer of Marianne Faithfull and Lou Reed.
Love
and
Marianne Faithfull so much.
And all these great musicians. I said, Hal, will you come with me? I don't want to go alone to meet Karen's husband because Scientologists are so scary. I don't want to be abducted by a Scientologist. So I met with Karen Black's husband to give money to him and his child, and he never looked at me in the eye. He got on the phone with Tony Basil and said, hey, Tony, I'm here with Hal Wilner from Saturday Night Live. And I was sitting next to Hal, kind of kicking Hal under the table. And I said, he doesn't see me.
Wow.
He doesn't see what I've done.
Why? Because?
Because I'm 5'3", 105-pound female, and he didn't understand how much muscle I had.
Amazing.
And I was the one putting on the show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hal wasn't there. Hal Whoa. Was there to just be my friend. So that was a sad day for me.
Was he a Scientologist as well, him and his daughter? It was a whole family.
I mean, I'm sure he was really traumatized. And it's just kind of indicative of a mentality from Los Angeles. Like if you get around really famous people get all mood altered.
Yeah.
And he saw Hal and dollar signs popped
yeah.
up. You know, he's like,
that's all he could see was that.
I'm with
yeah.
Hal,
yeah, yeah,
a
yeah.
man from Saturday Night Live. Yeah. And Hal was kicking me under the table saying, like, you know, don't worry, it's going to be fine.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I never was able, to do that benefit for Karen Black. That's how it started. She never got litigious with me. She was always supportive. And I mean, I did some pretty severe stuff mm-hmm. in my band.
Mm-hmm.
I sewed my vagina shut.
Mm-hmm.
I did things that would ruin your life if I felt like having a conservative career of any sort, it would be impossible because of what I've done. And I knew that, and I'm really proud of all that work. And
yes,
that's what Karen Black sensed.
Right.
Wow. So you see, when you sewed your vagina shut, is that still the case now?
No. I think that might be pretty hard, right? How would you use the restroom or do anything,
mm-hmm.
you know? No, we just did it. It was funny to do. It was funny. It wasn't a destructive maneuver.
Yeah.
It was just, it's easy to sew your vagina shut. You just take a needle and... you know, compared to all the other pain in the world and bad things that happen, it was easy to do.
And also, that work is documented in the Freeze project you're doing now. I think there's pictures of you.
Leopold encouraged me and curated a lot of the work that's up, you know. Thanks, Leopold. Because I don't really ever look backwards. I call it yesterbaiting.
Right.
To look backwards.
I like that. That's a hashtag.
Love that.
That's a hashtag. Yesterbaiting. Yes.
So I never look backwards. I don't know if this affects you both, if you're both doing art projects, galleries, and plays.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like if I look in the rear view mirror too much, I won't be here
You'll
in the
slow
day
down. Yeah.
for the present. Uh-huh. So I don't know. I don't even realize how old I am. I keep reminding myself. I forget that I'm 59 and
You look incredible for 59. Oh my God.
Yeah, it's because of having such an extreme 99% type lifestyle, you know? Like, I think if I was a 1%er, I would have spent a fortune on like hormone treatments and surgeries and everything. But I was with Violeta Sanchez, this artist from Thierry Mugler,
right,
who was a model. And Violeta said, I said, do you take hormones, Violeta? And she was like, "It's don't take any hormones because you're just, they're a man-made construct. Don't take hormones because you'll have to go through menopause twice. So I've never done anything that you're supposed to do when you get older. I've never done anything you're supposed to do when you're younger also. Mm-hmm. I've never spent a penny on beauty products. I don't buy anything.
Well, body paint. I mean, you must spend a fortune on body yeah, paint. True.
I have a sponsor.
Do you?
Do you really?
Yes.
That's handy. You
do you want to mention your? Too. Do you want to mention your sponsor?
You could get a sponsor. You probably have a sponsor too.
I've got a few things.
We actually have a sponsor for the podcast.
You ever get sponsors, well. Yeah.
But talking of the body paint, aren't you?
It's so, Alcone makeup, and I recommend Alcone. Okay. You'll meet them if you come to Broadway.
Okay.
They're wonderful for all theatrical, like Ben Nye Cosmetics, horror makeups.
Yes.
Prosthetics. They did The Lion King.
Wow.
They've been sponsoring me for over a decade.
How long does it take for you to do your whole body in the paint?
It depends. Sometimes if I do a quick punk show, I can do it in 5 minutes.
What, your whole body?
10 minutes, 15 minutes.
Really? That's
I awesome. Can do it.
You've got it down to a fine art.
And if I'm doing something for film and I need to keep the body paint on all day, like I did a Rick Owens fashion shoot for Candy Magazine with all of Rick's clothes, and I didn't want to ruin the clothes, so I did a kind of body paint that wouldn't ever come off.
Wow.
It was a latex. And so that took a few hours.
Wow.
So it doesn't take a long time.
And how do you choose what color you go for? Because the photograph you just showed us, you're on a surfboard in red, and performances I've seen you come on in blue, and you black out all your teeth.
Yeah.
And you wear big hair pieces, and you're not... You're right, okay. You normally are topless. Sometimes if you're in, like using Tompkins Square Park, when I saw you had pants on, but you had the top off, and then other ones you're completely naked. How do you decide on the color?
I think it's the color. Did you ever see classical Chinese opera? Like colors have an actual significance in Chinese opera. Like reds can indicate love, or blues can indicate sorrow, or the sky. So color therapy for me is I prefer cooler colors. I don't like primary colors on my body. I think it looks too comical. So I like cooler tones, and having this color on my body is the only time I really love to be surrounded by color. Like in my home, I don't have anything on the walls or any color around me at all. I think I do what I feel like doing. That's it, really. So it's really just about feeling. And I think that it's the same way you would probably choose paintings or how you would get dressed in the daytime. It's something that is something, if you listen to, it's just something that is an instinct. So.
And did you always start as yourself as Karen Black, and then the other Karen Black models came alongside you? Or was that always your kind of plan from the beginning?
Well, it's just something to do with my friends. And when I was doing a lot of shows with Jeffrey Deitch, Jeffrey would always say, why don't we get a school bus and fill it with girls of Karen Black? And I said, that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't my intention to have everyone be in my costume, no.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a nice way to include your sisters and brothers.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was a girl of Karen Black.
Really?
You're a great collaborator as well. I feel like you've sort of work with a lot of different people with different talents. And I think every time you collaborate with somebody, it becomes something so unique, which is what I was telling you earlier on, was this idea that if you look at someone like Lee Bowery, if Fergus Greer took a photograph of him, for me, it's an amazing photograph, of course, and Fergus Greer is amazing. But for me, it's always Lee that like really excites me. I always just end up thinking about how genius Lee Bowery is. And I kind of feel that with you, you know, even if someone takes a picture of you, I have a very similar reaction. Like You are a kind of living artwork.
Yes.
That'll be $5. That'll be £5.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Art, the arts podcast. And we're here today with Budweiser beer. And we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and Talk Art with Sir Peter Blake.
I always thought I should have a t-shirt that had my PayPal address on it and say, if you look at me, send money to PayPal.
Nice.
No, but nah. There's so many interesting artists around right now. I think it's a really hot time and a great time in the arts because it's a little more interdisciplinary, and there's a time when the film industry and actors and artists and musicians, everyone's a little bit loosening up to work with one another, I found. Like, I teach a performance class at
Columbia.
Yeah. And
what does that involve then? How do you do that? How do you teach?
I read my favorite books with them, Letters to a Young Poet by Rainer Maria Rilke, The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron, mm-hmm. Martin Scorsese's wife, mm-hmm. The Horror Show by David J. Skal. So there's a few texts we read, and then we start activating, and I teach them how to get bookings and do performance. And, you know, everyone has a performance in them, whether or not they want to do it in front of one person or 20 or 5,000. It's a very personal experience. So it's not entertainment. It's just a medium.
Mm-hmm. And I heard that for you, like going to the microphone was quite a big deal because you a lot of your early work, like when you had, I know when you did that extremist kind of show in New York that we spoke about earlier in the mid-80s, you had like an image of you, I think it was you physically, but with your boots or something tied behind you or something, mm-hmm. and you were walking, but often you said they were in silence. And then going to the mic,
all silent.
Yeah. So going to the microphone and actually singing or, you know, or performing with your voice was actually quite a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know how people become drug addicts and alcoholics when they start rock bands?
Yes.
I stopped using drugs and alcohol when I started my rock band. And life would be so boring without singing and loud music. It was just like also a panacea for me to start singing and doing the band. I stopped using drugs and alcohol in the 80s when my best friend and my first relationship died of AIDS. And literally everyone died around me. And it was the first time when all of us looked at one another and said, it's not really cool for us to be killing ourselves when our best friends are dying involuntarily. Mm. So it was a big change for a lot of us. There was a big wave of putting down drugs and alcohol in the 80s.
And deciding to live.
Yeah, we had to. And then ACT UP started. And
Yeah. And one of your early collaborators, Gordon.
Gordon Curtie,
yeah. So I heard about how amazing he was. And a lot of your early work was in a collaboration with him.
It was. And he died of AIDS. And his death was so fast and so tragic. And, you know, he'd run away from his family, really, these Irish Catholic people from the Bronx. And when he passed away, his family came back to him and surrounded him and wouldn't let any of his friends see him pass away.
God.
And it was really traumatic for us all. That's what Karen Finley's poem, The Black Sheep, is about. I really recommend to your listeners for them to look up The Black Sheep. It's really powerful. But, you know, everyone in every decade, my students in my class, they're Gen Zers, Generation Zs.
Yes.
And then there's alphas too, so they're really young. So they say to me, what was it like losing all of your friends to AIDS and everything? And I was like, well, it's like it still is now. Don't you know teenagers that are getting AIDS? Because I do. Kids are getting AIDS. Everyone's getting AIDS still all the time, even using PrEP. Like, PrEP's really big in New York City, the anti-AIDS drug. So, and a lot of times now people are acting out so intensely because the world's coming to an end. Mm. There's a lot of really intense behaviors all around that. So there's just as much trauma now as there was in the 80s. I keep telling all of my students, I was like, don't worry about the trauma that I had when I was a teenager. You've got enough of your own right now.
Yeah.
Like, you've got enough. They do.
And I think it is important for people to just keep talking about it because I feel like a lot of people think it's sort of ended or something.
An antique.
And because
it's not. You still get it. I told the kids yesterday in class, I was like, it's embarrassing enough to have sex, even though it's easier these days, but it's harder to have sex when you have to tell somebody you have HIV.
Yeah, so,
something I've been thinking a lot about recently is this idea of how society wants to kind of define who we all are. So if you meet somebody and they say, what do you do? Who are you? You have to sort of be able to succinctly say who you are.
Yeah.
And when I was looking at your kind of history of everything you've done, it's so multidisciplinary and so crosses so many boundaries, but at the same time, it's always you and it's always so pure and so clear what it is. And to me, it's just one, you know, one artist doing their work. And yeah. I find it so irritating. And I was talking to Zoe, who curated that show I told you about this idea that especially women, I think everyone's trying to define them. And we've been interviewed by a number of people over the last few weeks, and everybody wants to know who she is and why, you know, why she was curating this show. How is she a curator when in fact she hasn't necessarily created loads of shows before? But to me, it doesn't matter why. You know, I feel that we can just all be creative in different ways. Mm. And I think you're a great example of that, and why I want to like champion you and scream your name from the rooftops, because I feel like you're saying, this younger generation, we are all talking to each other from different disciplines. And
I hope so. I mean, that's one thing that the class asked me to teach at Columbia. I didn't try out for a teaching job at Columbia. The students in my class asked me because I started a performance class in my apartment called Performance Art 101. And I did that because we also had podcasts too. We had a podcast with Performance Art 101, and everyone was listening to it. So I started having students in my house.
How many would you have at a time?
From 1 to 20.
That's amazing. And did it ever get like, was you happy with all the students, or were some of them a bit kind of?
I didn't have any problems except for one student that I asked to work for me, and she lost her mind because she had trauma and she had some problems. So there's always people that crack like an egg. That's okay. Bad stuff happens, but like Charles Bukowski said, it's so much easier just to trust, and you just trust until you don't.
And that's actually what I said to someone who was interviewing us. I said to them that for me, it's about trust. And as a gallerist, you have to just trust who you work with. And if you can believe in someone, and sometimes it's cerebral and you have to really think about it intellectually. And of course, that's really important. But the other side is the gut. And, you know, I've spent enough time with artists now to know when someone's, you know, being true to their voice and trying to do the best work they can make, and they might not have made it yet. And you have to realize that even someone at the age of 50 might not have done their greatest artwork yet, and they might do it at the age of 70. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and I think it's really important to open our minds and realize that we don't have to be an artist or just, you know, defined as one tiny thing on a Wikipedia page. You know, it's so boring, and it's not what art is about. You know, it's not one tiny little thing. It's like, it's bigger than that.
I was hoping that this year, I always ask everyone that I come across, I wish that we had another, if we're changing a system, what would we call ourselves if we didn't call ourselves artists? Yeah. Like in Bali, they don't really, do they have an art scene in Bali where, I don't think that they have an actual art scene. Everything is creative and artistic in Bali, I heard.
Well, I was just there about a year ago. And
really?
I went there. Well, a friend of mine took me on holiday there, so it was a really generous thing of her. And I got there, and she kind of tricked me because I'm really not very sporty. And she was like, you're here to learn to surf. So I just took it on, and I thought, you know what? At the age of 36, 37, I was going to learn to surf. So I did it, and I went in the sea, and it was the best experience, the most humbling thing I've ever done, because you're there with the board and the waves, and I learned how much I love the sea, and I didn't feel scared at all. And some of my friends were scared of like sharks or this stuff, because I think there've been a few sharks in the area, but for me, I just felt the most peaceful I've ever felt. And you're right, in Bali, it is all creative, and it's not like there's an art scene necessarily.
It's not like that's a separate job.
No, exactly. It's like everything, even like you sit on a table in a restaurant and the way they've put the flowers together is really artistic or something. Mm. It's all very creative there.
I wonder, it'd be fun to, like we're calling my class interdisciplinary art, and that they used to call it multimedia.
Yes.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So there's maybe, you know, Shakespeare used to always invent new words, and we sort of stopped inventing new words in the English language. Like, I love the word availabilism.
Did you create that?
You created
that. I did.
Yes,
yeah.
I love that. And availabilism is using what's available.
I mean, there's so much new technology and so many new things happening that I don't think have an actual word to describe it. Mm. You know, there's there's so much possibility for new language. Mm. So I like the idea of making up new language. And I used to work at Oxford University Press, and they told me that the dictionary, if you wanted to get a new word in the dictionary, it only had to be in print 3 times.
Really?
Yeah, and it would be a real word.
Well, we've got so, I think we'll have to try that. It's a social experiment.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you talk about Shakespeare making up new words. I found out recently that he made up the word drag, because drag is a stage direction that says dressed as a girl. And it's an acronym for dressed as a girl in Shakespeare plays, yes.
That's so good.
Isn't that amazing?
I can't believe I didn't know that.
I know, what a great fact, isn't it? Yes.
It's funny because a lot of people that I work with that are a lot younger than me like to work from in bed, you know, because you can put your computer in bed and stuff. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I find that if you leave the house, you really can, you know, happy accidents happen mm-hmm. and running into people that you might not have planned on meeting. Mm-hmm. I love the idea of synchronicities and happy accidents, and that comes from actually leaving the house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and
that's
a lot
so
of
true.
Times people that I'm speaking to these days, they get so overwhelmed and so confused with making so many choices, they mm-hmm. just stay online in bed all day.
Wow.
And work. And I mean, we have to work in our studios when we're artists to create new work, of
yeah.
course.
Yeah.
But like in Harlem, where I teach at Columbia, none of the people that I'm teaching in school know what's going on in Harlem. They don't yeah. know, they didn't know about the Apollo Theater.
They must go to the Studio Museum.
Nope.
Really?
They didn't know anything That's about crazy. Harlem.
Do you like teaching?
Yes and no. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm just learning. I don't really know what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
My mother likes it,
mm-hmm.
you know, because my mother has always been so afraid of me. Like my boyfriend died of cancer and stuff. And, you know, she gets worried about me, what's going to happen to me. My two brothers are in bands too, and we're all artists. Thanks, Leopold. What's this immune system?
It's an Actimel. It's got L-Cas immunitas. It's got like nice,
it tastes
thanks
nice.
Good, for that.
Good bacteria in it.
Thank you so much.
That's all right. Well, that should help with your jet lag a little.
My mom worries about, my mother worries about me, and she's going to die soon because she's, you know, always talking about it. I'm going to die soon. I'm going to die soon. I'm going to die soon. And she, you know, she lives in Hawaii, and she just loves that I'm teaching at Columbia.
Oh.
So she's just telling all of her Hawaiian friends mm-hmm. that I'm teaching at Columbia. She's really proud of that. And I don't think she's loved Karen Black, and she's seen everything I've done. My parents mm-hmm. always came to see my artwork all through the years. And a lot of extreme artists like me often leave their parents
yeah.
and leave their homes.
Well, they must find it tough to see the work. Didn't your mum find it very tough to see you
she did.
Sew up your own vagina?
She really did, yeah.
And what was her? Did she see gross. The video? She saw the film of it? Or
she covered her eyes, you know, of course. Mm. My mom's a mom, and she just, I just told her I was very angry and doing future feminism with Anoni and Coco Rosie and Johanna. Future feminism, we addressed a lot of the stuff that they talked about in the U2 movement, but they kind of...
I don't know what the YouTube movement is. What's
U2,
that?
U2.
Oh, U2 movement. Sorry.
When,
oh, yeah.
Is when we all started, when misogyny came to the forefront of our culture.
Yeah.
And that essentially, misogyny and sexism started to come to the forefront. But in America, what happened was the media monetized it. So that was the primary concern for attention towards females and misogyny. And it's just a trend,
right.
sort of. So,
do you think that's what Me Too's turned into? Like that whole
it
thing?
It always was
yeah,
that.
Exactly.
It was monetized.
Yeah.
And, but it, doing future feminism in 2014 helped me a lot with to articulate to my mom why I was so angry for being devalued and being female. But still, you know, when you're a struggling artist and you're an artist all your life, you have to question why you're doing it anyways, and you're not doing it for the approval of others. So, huh.
Yeah. Well, I love that you're teaching. I think it's such a brilliant thing.
Yeah, I do too.
Because I think you're, whether you realize it or not, I think you have an incredible generosity and I really feel it in the work.
Really?
And I'm grateful for that just as a like recipient of the work in that sense, like, you know, watching it and being a viewer of it. I take so much like strength from
I mean,
it
is, it's really, it's, and what your work is incredibly entertaining. It's also
as
like
well,
equally
exactly.
fascinating and
yeah.
moving
really? Yeah.
and shocking. And you're we're witnessing things that we don't normally, you wouldn't be looking for, you wouldn't know would arrive. And I think
it's
people,
really nice of you guys to say that, because most people just threw rocks and stones and bottles at me.
Oh,
but
no.
You know what? All the greatest artists have that.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of the best artists are the ones that right now probably like don't even get seen or heard in these bigger galleries and everything. But then often is the case, especially with women, which really pisses me off, they will get discovered once they've gone.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, once they're really old, you know, like if they're like 98,
and then they've got
then
like a few years
like they're
to
no
enjoy
longer
it.
Threatening
yeah.
or something. It's
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm glad
that's what the queer population of the world and other races have been experiencing this since the Industrial Revolution and
course,
since the
yeah.
turn of the century.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Emmalin said to me that Leopold's gallery and Angelina's gallery, they said, we want to work with you and work on your things until for as long as we can.
That's
and
wonderful.
And so that really struck a chord with me. So
yeah.
I think I might be a little popular now, but it'll change.
We're going to make you more popular. We're shouting your name from the rooftops.
But like
Rob
you say, what I like
you.
Though is that it doesn't matter whether you're being popular or not
matter.
Popular. It's kind of irrelevant. It's kind of what's important is you making your work and
I mean,
being able
you
to continue
you
making
both
your work.
Must have experienced highs and lows doing
of
all
totally.
Of the, and then you have to come to this place of questioning why you're doing it
mm-hmm.
and really loving the work that you do.
Mm-hmm.
And then when things are going well, what kind of service you can be to the community around you and
totally.
What you could give back. Like, the Lower East Side is such a great place and people always come there and say they're from there, and but they never come back. They never fix buildings or build community centers or help the artists or help the neighbors there. They just sort of really devour my neighborhood and the Lower East Side. That irritates me, and I never wanted to leave the Lower East Side when I found it because I love Dominican and Puerto Rican people so much. They saved my life, that community.
I heard you talk about that before, where you talked about how they were very family-orientated and really kind of community, and there was this real strong sense of that, which is something I never really thought about in the Lower East, like, because I wasn't there, obviously. I was born in 1980, and like I sort of grew up hearing about it, but I've never heard it described like that. And it's so, I love that you described it like that because it's so accurate probably to what the experience was like
it's
to be there.
It's the core of the Lower East Side, Miguel Pinheiro and Luis Guzman, who's a great actor, television actor, grew up on the Lower East Side. The Puerto Rican and Dominican people, if they would see me on the street, they would say, can you please come over for dinner? And what are you doing? Like, you've got to put a jacket on. You're not, I was from California. And even the punk kids, being from California was like being from outer space. And
right.
when I got there in 1979, I went to school with Keith Haring and Jean-Michel Basquiat was around, and I was even a different kind of punk kid.
Did you meet Warhol?
I didn't, but Colin did.
Really?
Colin Deland met Warhol.
Mm-hmm.
I got to spend a lot of time with Lou Reed.
Wow.
That was really life-changing for me.
Wow.
And Laurie Anderson. And
I love Laurie Anderson so much.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
She was in the audience of your show, wasn't she, recently?
Well, we did a play together.
You did a play together as well.
I did a play with Anoni called She Who Saw Beautiful Things at the Kitchen, which you might visit when you're there.
Yeah.
I
know he was, they were Antonina Johnson's.
Yeah, won the Mercury Prize and is an artist that I get to work with a lot. She's in Ireland now.
Where do you live now, then, if you're not Lower East Side?
I live, where do I live now?
Yeah.
I have a home on the Lower East Side,
I
go to Los Angeles. I'm from there, and I go to Hawaii a lot.
Right,
I love.
Does that say Hawaii on your neck? Is that
yeah, it says Hawaii. Just just a
with
little,
a cherry.
Yeah, I got that a long time ago. I took most of my tattoos off. They were all over my arms, but I took them off.
You had them all lasered off?
Yeah.
How was that?
It was fun.
Fun? I've never had anyone
call
it fun.
Transformation, I guess.
There we
it's
go.
Like,
yeah, yeah,
it looked
yeah.
horrible to have big tattoos all over my arms. I took them off.
Cool.
We talked about success earlier, and there's a phrase that someone said that if you like your own work, then you are a success. And do you like your own work, the work you're making? Do you feel...
I like my drawings now, but I need to do more. I need to make more time for myself to draw more because my drawings are really temperamental. And Leopold was encouraging me to draw more.
Yeah, well, I tried to buy some drawings from yours recently, and we were actually on discussion email. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, oh, yeah, I'll get some. He said, sorry, they've just sold. So I just walked onto the booth straight away and bought all of them. Yeah.
We were talking about, before you arrived here tonight, we were talking about your drawings. And, you know,
yeah,
you're so
I
well known for,
drawings.
Like, the performances and all of that side of you and even just you. But I feel like the drawings, I really wanted to talk about them because I find them so personal. And they're so, like, we've always loved drawings by artists, but I particularly love yours.
Yeah, your style.
They're fantastic.
Because of the Because your character, the Karen Black character that appears, and the hair and the makeup and the black teeth. And
it's done with the makeup that I use.
Oh, it is?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I really love drawing and painting, and it's really something that the drawings are just a lot more temperamental. And I feel like the girls of Karen Black get shy to come out, like they don't want to appear on the page or something. It's really performative doing drawings with these things. So I'm vowing, and that's what I'd like to do, is do more drawings and spend more time with my hand, you know, like actual drawing with my hand, because we all have hands and we can all draw actually. And I find that doing drawings is like nonfiction illustration, because I actually do the things in my drawings. Like I do the sewn vagina, and it's not
and
just
the vagina
a special
wall
effect,
you've done, haven't you?
The wall of vagina.
Yeah.
But I've always loved drawings, and I have a lot of drawings in the Museum of Modern Art, actually.
Oh, do they have you in their collection?
They do.
Wow.
And that was something that Colin Deland organized, actually.
That's
so
great.
But Leopold's and the gal Emmeline's been really encouraging to, and that helps a lot. Mm-hmm.
The other thing I love is the sit-in works. So the works where they're almost like, on a basic level, if you think of like Eve Klein.
I love Eve Klein
exactly,
so much.
But I mean for people to understand what the work looks like, that's probably the quickest way for people to get a vision of what it might be like. So you're using your own body and then almost like sitting on the page. And I think some of those works will be at Frieze maybe.
It's really athletic to do that because I used to be a gymnast and I tried to get the girls of Karen Black to sit on the page, but it's funny, no one can do those things that I do really, those physical things. It's a little bit difficult. I don't take for granted the things that I do physically. Most of the girls of Karen Black just can't do it.
Well,
so
I think that's what makes you unique. Yeah. You have such a unique physicality. And I was going to compare it to being like an athlete, actually.
It feels like it, but it's just surfing. Having balance, too. Did you fall off your surfboard a lot when
you know,
you surfed?
It took me 4.5 days until I could stand. And by the time I could stand, and I'm 6'2", so I'm quite big, and I found it incredibly hard to get the balance, but even just to get up there.
Mm.
And then what I did was I got these little sock things, like water kind of suit socks.
Booties.
And then the minute I did that, because I've got size 14 feet American, so they've got quite big, chunky feet, and they're really annoying. So I kept knocking my feet, and I had all these like cuts all over my skin, and it was just driving me crazy. And it really hurt, but I was adamant I was going to do it by the time I left. And by the 4.5 days in, I finally stood, and it was one of the best moments of my life. I felt like I had conquered myself and conquered like nature, and it was just this whole incredible revelation. And then I stayed there for another week and a half and got to surf every day, and it was just a magical.
But that's like if you ski in any of them sort of sports that need that.
I found it harder than skiing though.
Did you?
Yeah, because you're in the sea and you've got this kind of gravity pulling you all the time, and it's so huge and you're so tiny in the water.
And there's sharks too.
Yes, but it's just.
What do you do in London too? What if it is not rude to ask? Do you do sports in London?
Gym and cycling, I do.
Bicycling.
Yeah.
Well, in Margate, where I've moved to by the sea, I'm swimming a lot in the water. And
you started yoga.
And I've started yoga and I've started walking, but I haven't done enough exercise.
You walked a lot when you was in London, though. I used to walk everywhere.
I used to walk for like 5 hours a day. I was crazy. And I still love, I love that about Margate, because you can walk across the whole town within 10 minutes, 15 minutes. So everything is like a 15-minute walk. So I'm forcing myself to walk and get healthier again. But
what have you got planned to do while you're in London? What's on your to-do list, the Kembra to-do list?
Well, I want to draw, and I want to really look around, because I haven't really seen a lot of London. And I just... I want to draw, and there's a certain kind of paper that I like here that Leopold and I, actually we found it in Denmark. We found the, my favorite paper, and then we were
What's
able.
That? What is it?
I don't know. It's just the kind of paper size that we liked a lot. It's about 30 by 22, 24. Is that about how big it is? It's just the size that we liked.
Yeah. Is that in inches? Yeah,
in inches.
Yeah.
Wow, I don't know the other system.
No, that's perfect. Amazing.
So it's kind of user-friendly size. So I like the paper here a lot.
Nice.
And, I like a lot of the buildings that I get to see. I'm not a big traveler, and I'm afraid of Europe because it all reminds me of like Blow Up, the movie Blow Up.
Right.
Is that bad to say?
No, not at all.
I get
interviewed Janet Street Porter, who's in a scene of Blow Up dancing. She's in like a dancing scene in it. She spoke about it when we interviewed her.
I think the photographer lives in Shoreditch.
Okay.
Oh, really?
David Bailey?
Oh, yeah, he probably does.
He lives in Shoreditch. Yeah. I want to meet him. That would be nice.
And you're staying in the Barbican area, you were saying.
I'm staying as long as it, hopefully, I get to visit Leopold. And I just really don't get to see people that often because I'm working a lot all the time, but
so
that's all I'm gonna do. And I have t-shirts for you guys. I forgot.
We wear that. We've got to do a picture afterwards. We wear it for the picture.
I'm so sorry. They're at Leopold's. Oh. Is there a way I can?
Well, I'm gonna be at Frieze, so I've got a booth at Frieze.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just about to say maybe I can wear it at Frieze. That'd be very cool.
It's a sewn vagina one. You probably won't want to wear it. It makes people throw up.
You never know. I might well do it.
Is it a photograph or is it a drawing?
It's a photograph. Wow. It's the Richard picture. Sorry, it's a really offensive t-shirt.
We love offensive t-shirts, especially when they're made by you.
Yeah. And
we're
all about it's offensive elegant t-shirts. Looking too. Exactly. It's not that bad, but it still upsets people on the subway in New York. I don't know how to drink this Actimel.
You just do it like a little
just
shot.
Drink it like that, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Just like sip it.
Okay, yeah.
What do you think of that?
It's really
it's got
strawberry.
Funny bacteria in it. Yeah.
Bacteria is great. I'm an anti-naturalist, so I live on things that are anti-natural, like, you know, city living.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the flaneurs in France. Do you know about the flaneurs?
Yeah.
I love them.
Well, I don't know what that is.
Oh.
I just learned about them. It's nothing that I've known about for a long time. A flaneur was a dandy.
Oh, okay.
We were actually talking about it in another interview recently.
Were we?
Yeah. You know who spoke about it? Jasmine from JTT.
Really?
Yeah, when she was talking about Borna Samak. She was talking about flaneurs.
So where are we now? Where is your home?
We're in Shoreditch. So
I don't want people to stop you here.
My address and my phone number.
Yeah, exactly.
We're in a Shoreditch area.
Shoreditch area.
So we're near the barbecue.
Near David Bailey.
Okay.
Near David Bailey. David Bailey is my neighbour.
So yeah. This is such a great place.
Thanks.
So we ask
every guest who comes on the show two questions.
Really hard questions.
Okay. Very hard questions. It's like investigative journalism.
Okay.
So the first one is, if you could do an art heist and take home any work you wanted, and it could be as huge as you like or as tiny as you like, what would you take home?
I'm sort of against stealing because it's such bad karma, because I feel like there's so much abundance in the world. I really don't steal anything. I try not to. I do steal from church, though. I did take like the priest costumes a few times.
Did you?
When I went to my drug program, I left with like half of the wardrobe. Sorry. Oh my
God. Did you ever take the crucifixes from the church that you use in your performances?
I did actually. Yes.
Did you?
I
Are
did,
they officially
actually.
From a church?
They're from Father Delgado from East 4th Street. And when he gave it to me, he gave me a 1960s crucifix that I took home and sprayed black and shoved in my butt. Sorry.
Wow.
But, you know, I was mad at that church because they wouldn't bury any women that had worked as prostitutes and any women that were addicts or single mothers. So that church wouldn't sanctify women that had fallen. And I thought that wasn't Christian.
No, not at all. So you took the crucifix painted black and put it up your ass, and you were
I did, actually. So I did.
Did you go back and tell him? Does he know this happened?
Father Delgado is a really good friend of mine, and I've known him for years. It was a Church of the Most Holy Redeemer. Mm. So there's a few things I've stole. That's a really good question. What would I steal? What art would I steal?
Yeah, like a touchstone and, artwork, something that you visit all the time and you go and see.
Or an artwork that means a lot to you.
Yeah.
Well, I would like David, you know.
Michelangelo's.
Yeah, I'd like David. I'd like to just have David in my apartment. Same. And paint a tile red.
And you'd actually paint the original as well.
I'd paint the original.
With body paint? With Karen Black body paint? Or
I just paint it tile red.
So talking about tile red.
I love the Renaissance. I take a really, really just iconic Renaissance. Something just so iconic that like millions of tourists would be wanting to come and see. And then I'd put myself on See David at like Kemper's house or something like that. I
love that.
So I'd take something like that just for its muscle.
Yeah.
I love the Medici family, and I love that the Italian Renaissance was all about turning the lights on, like consciousness raising. Maybe that's happening now. Mm-hmm. Do you think? I think it might be. Mm-hmm. I feel like the lights have been turned on a little bit.
Well, I feel like everyone's more woke, to use that hashtag.
I think we have to be.
I don't think it's the most political the world's ever been.
Yeah.
We have to be. We don't have a choice.
No, we don't.
Or else we're not going to have a day like today.
No.
Or a visit like today.
Exactly, yeah.
No.
Or an Actimel.
You're not going to have all that bacteria.
No.
In London.
It'll be over, I feel like,
unless there's systemic change. And
yes.
So I'm hoping for the best.
Me too.
I believe it. And I really believe there is hope and there is a future, and art will help massively with that.
And talking about systemic change, our second question is, what's your favourite colour? That's no correlation to systemic change.
I love tile red.
Oh.
I love black and tile red.
Uh-huh.
And mostly tile red is my favorite color, but...
That's like terracotta, like subway tile red.
Do you have tile red in that piece there?
That's
tile red that I like a lot.
Can I ask you something about tile red quickly? Isn't your apartment all painted tile red?
Yes.
So like every single thing in it, basically, like the wardrobes, like there's a giant penis, isn't there? Sculpture.
Oh, do you live with the giant penis?
I sawed the last one in half that it was tile red in my house, and I turned it into a piñata.
Wow.
So I'm going to do a performance with that. And the statue is at Emmeline, the disco statue.
That's still there. Emmeline. Cool. Mm-hmm. So, but the one you saw in half, did you go from the top to bottom, or did you cut like the balls off?
Just cut it in half.
From like split it in half, where you took the head of the penis and the ball separate.
I cut it in half. Like I didn't. Let's see. How would you explain that? A vertical chop, not a lateral.
Straight down.
Not straight down.
Oh, a horizontal chop. So you took the head of the penis off.
Wow. Yeah, and you know it's. I just got into the whole cock show because I'd been showing my own body so much, and I have two brothers, and I have a really good father. I just wanted to really, really have a man show too. So I thought that's why I did that.
I love it. When are you going to do this performance?
Next week, probably.
In London or back in the States?
In the United States. I'll film it and put it on YouTube. But I watched Blade Runner 2049 about five times on the plane in many different languages. And I love the writer of that film, Hampton Fancher.
Uh-huh.
He wrote the first Blade Runner.
Right.
And there was a big change in that sci-fi film where there was a blackout in like 2020. And the blackout would have been similar to us losing all of our photos on the clouds that we're using and having all of our computer system wiped out. So I believe that science fiction is prophetic, and specifically Philip K. Dick. So I'm waiting for the blackout of that size that wipes out all of our information so that we're left with nothing again. I feel like that's bound to happen with the rate
just a reset
with the amount of space that this is occupying. where's it going? Where's the cloud?
Mm.
Do you know?
No.
I don't know where it is.
It's quite terrifying and odd, actually.
I do actually picture an actual cloud, though, when we talk about iCloud.
Do you pay 2 cents for it, too? Does it
I pay for iCloud storage.
Me too.
Yeah, me too.
So I'm going to try to get all my imagery on paper and put everything on paper again and make records again, because I'm not trusting that this information isn't going to be completely demolished like it was in Hampton Fancher's Blade Runner 2049.
Well, that is a great way to tie up the interview, because that is a big thing for people to think about.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an Instagram?
I do. It's Kembra Fowler _. And thanks so much for being your kind words. I'm embarrassed a little bit. I'm not embarrassed in a bad way. I'm really glad to be here. It's just your home is beautiful, and I'm really excited about your play.
Thank you.
I cannot wait for that.
You know what? You'll come backstage and everything.
I'm actually coming out to New York for a month at the beginning of the year, and then I'll be there when he's on Broadway. We should go together and see him in it.
I'd be so honored. Let me just quickly say, the first Broadway play that I saw was The Elephant Man with David Bowie, and my mother took me, 1979. And I go to Broadway every chance I get. I've seen Grey Gardens, I've seen Kinky Boot, I've seen 49th Street, Times Square. I've seen every Broadway play I can, because the Broadway theaters are some of the few things that haven't been gentrified and physically changed.
Yeah.
The content is a little bit Disney-ish, but... Mm.
But the community spirit is there in Broadway.
It's still untouchable.
Yeah, it is untouchable.
And I told my students at class on Friday that we were going to go to a Broadway play together. And I think Broadway's having an upswing with content and things getting more interesting.
Yes.
Hopefully.
You know, I've been talking to a lot of friends recently about how lucky we are to be alive now in many ways, because I think you have to remember that even though we're going through all these turbulent political times and it is quite terrifying, we're actually really lucky because there's so many great artists, and there have been so many great artists alive while we're alive.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, like David Bowie, I was actually thinking about it earlier, but yourself included in this, you know, like Grace Jones, just like all the kind of phenomenons that we've had, like these incredible... strong people.
Cultural, iconic movement.
And even Christine now, and yourself. And like, there's so many people that I love, and I'm so happy that I was alive to witness all of what you're all doing.
It's important that we all reach out to one another. That's what I always suggest to the kids in my class too. We made lists of people we wanted to meet, and they were thinking, oh, this will never happen. I'll never get to meet this or that artist. And it's really important to seek those people
out. Definitely.
You know?
Like-minded kind of kindred spirits.
Even if they seem unapproachable, because, I don't know, it's possible.
Totally.
Everything's possible.
I think this podcast has made us realize that.
Well, like you're on our list.
You were on our list.
And
you were 100% on our list. And now we've met you. We're very, very happy.
That's an amazing thing.
You'll probably be disappointed. I almost threw up because I ate so much weird stuff at the airport.
Well, you had a bag of donuts and a cheese sandwich, you told us, right?
I just went to the gas station by the airport and got a cheese sandwich in the middle of the night. So I'm glad I didn't really get sick at your house. That would have been really uncool.
And I loved that. I heard a podcast you did a while ago with Lydia Lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And you were saying that when she wrote a text or a book or something about healthy eating, it sort of made you start realizing you shouldn't just eat donuts all the time and eat a bit healthier. And it took you hearing Lydia Lunch saying that made you think about what you're eating.
The need to feed.
Yeah, the need to feed. That's right. So also I recommend checking out that podcast if you're listening to this one right now. Lydia Lunch is so genius. And if you don't know who Lydia Lunch is, you need to know. So just listen. That's all I'm going to say.
Is that her real name, Lydia Lunch?
You need to go listen, because
I haven't listened. I haven't listened.
But I would like to thank you so much.
Thank you so much
for joining us on Talk Up.
Yay!
And for images.
Revolution!
For images of everything we've talked about, visit at Talk Art on Instagram, and we will be back very soon. Thank you, Kembra.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. Bye.
Ding, 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 ding,
ding, ding, ding, ding, ding, ding, ding, ding, ding, ding. Love it. You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art on iTunes and Spotify. Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hold up. treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.